Cancer can take away all my physical abilities. It cannot touch my mind, it cannot touch my heart, and it cannot touch my soul. And those three things are going to carry on forever.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Voices for Victory podcast. I'm your host, Mick McDonald. We continue to be over the moon about all the great feedback we're getting from our listeners. And as we continue to gain new subscribers, we want to welcome you aboard. We're glad to have you with us. Here on the Voices for Victory podcast, we share stories from people whose lives have been affected by cancer and how they are helping us move closer to victory over cancer. Today, we're focusing on the BRCA or BRCA gene and why mutations to it can be so impactful. As we continue to learn more about genetics and how that can affect us, specifically in regard to cancer, BRCA has become something more and more people are hearing about. But what do we really know about it? I decided to ask Carol Wagner, the V Foundation's Senior Vice President of Grants and Research Administration, to clear up some misunderstandings about the BRCA gene and fill us in on how the V Foundation is funding research related to it. Then we chat with Jennifer Halsey, who lost both her mom and aunt to cancer and tested positive for the BRCA gene mutation. She tells us the decisions that diagnosis led her to make and all she's gone through following it. First up, our conversation with Carol Wagner.
And I always have to think about what's important in life is to think to me of three things: where you started, where you are, and where you're going to be. Those are the three things that I try and do every day.
And we are now joined on the Voices for Victory podcast by Carol Wagner. Carol, thanks so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us today.
Hi, of course. My pleasure.
So first off, Carol, can you just kind of walk us through what the BRCA gene is and why the mutations associated with it are so impactful?
Sure. So the BRCA genes, when they're in their normal state, they actually function as a tumor suppressor because they are involved in DNA repair. So as you may know, our cells are multiplying and they're undergoing replication of strands of DNA all the time. And usually that replication is correct. But sometimes there are sections of the DNA that have become damaged or broken, and the BRCA genes produce tumor suppressor proteins that their job is to repair those damaged sections of DNA. So we have a built-in repair system through the BRCA genes. So this repair work normally keeps the cells functioning normally as they're supposed to, but if that BRCA gene is itself damaged or mutated, then the worker proteins they make are likely to be incorrectly made and they're unable to do their repair work, which then increases the risk that cells carrying any unrepaired damaged DNA will transition to cancer.
That's a great explanation, Carol. Thank you. And I know, I think in the general public and certainly for people who aren't in the scientific field, there can be a little bit of a misunderstanding that, BRCA, for obvious reasons why people think this is only associated with breast cancer. But that's not the case, of course. Can you kind of help clear up those misconceptions about it for us?
Sure. There's an interesting kind of history behind that. So the BRCA gene mutations, they come in at least two flavors, or the ones that we're most familiar with are BRCA1 and BRCA2. There's actually a lot more than that, but those are the two that we know the most about. These two mutated versions were first discovered in breast cancer cells, and the name BRCA comes from BR for breast and CA for cancer. But as we learned more, as the research progressed, we found these mutated BRCA genes found in a lot of other cancers. To date, there is evidence of mutated BRCA genes playing a role in increased cancer risk for not only breast cancer and ovarian cancer, but also pancreatic cancer, prostate cancer, fallopian tube and peritoneal cancer, and even melanoma, which is a type of skin cancer. Keep in mind, though, that there are other causes of all these cancers, but having a mutated version of the BRCA genes increases your risk for any of these cancers. Again, it makes sense when you think that being able to efficiently and consistently repair the DNA breaks in your cells would seem to be protective across cell types. So if you have a mutation in BRCA, you could expect, mayhem across cancer cell types.
It's interesting. That's a great breakdown, Carol. Thank you. The V Foundation, of course, funds research across all types of cancer. How has the V Foundation kind of focused in specifically on research related to BRCA?
Yeah, so BRCA has been of interest to the V Foundation and to the scientists we support for some time. Our support of BRCA research began in 1999 when we awarded grants to two young V scholars. both of these, I was looking at their website just the other day, they're still very productive scientists. One of them is still working on the BRCA gene. In total, we've invested in 7 vSCHOLARS to pursue this research. The vSCHOLARS are early career grant for young researchers just building their labs at the assistant professor level. But then we've also invested over, since 1999, over $10 million in 17 grants in a variety of areas related to BRCA, BRCA. In 2018, probably one of our biggest efforts is a 3-way collaborative effort where the V Foundation, we worked with the Goldberg Family Foundation and the Gray Foundation to award $7.5 million in grants to 5 different research institutions to work on various aspects of BRCA-related cancers. So these grants, questions in these grants range from increasing our understanding of the biology of these cancers to preventing these cancers and even helping launch a new clinical trial. Most recently, in 2019, we had another collaboration between the Goldberg Family Foundation and the Gray Foundation, which made possible a $1 million grant to University of California at San Francisco to further study the use of PARP inhibitors. Now, that's an interesting kind of story, too, related back to DNA repair. PARP, P-A-R-P, stands for poly-ADP ribose polymerases, and that's a family of proteins that are involved in DNA repair. So a question might be, so why would you use a PARP inhibitor to kill cancer cells? If you inhibit the PARP proteins, you get an accumulation of broken strands of DNA. In a cell with a normal BRCA gene that's exposed to this PARP inhibitor, then you have the BRCA repair mechanisms can take over and the cell survives and everything is fine. If you have a BRCA mutated cell that, you know, may well be cancerous, then these repair mechanisms are damaged and the resulting chaos and the accumulating broken strands of DNA lead to cell death. So so we've invested in that as well. So there's numerous areas we've invested in since 1999. There's also another work we've supported at Stanford to create better tools for screening for cancer in high-risk individuals that are BRCA positive using liquid biopsy. So this work uses next-generation DNA sequencing from standard blood samples to identify circulating tumor DNA mutations. And this could be a very sensitive marker of early cancers in high-risk individuals. The hope is that these liquid biopsies may prove to be a far easier and more sensitive way to screen for cancer than our current imaging-based approaches like mammograms, MRIs, et cetera. So that's another area we've been supporting on the screening front.
Yeah, that's great recap there. And it's interesting to me how kind of many different fronts or different areas of attack can be related to BRCA. And that's just some of the work that the V Foundation has funded. Carol, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to chat with us today to inform our audience a little bit more about what the BRCA gene mutations are and how they can affect people and then how the V Foundation is working to move things forward in that area. So thank you so much for coming on and talking with us for a few minutes. And hopefully we'll have you back on again sometime to keep the people updated on all of the things going on with the V Foundation's grants.
You're very welcome. I hope it was helpful. Thanks.
And now we chat with Jennifer Halsey. And we are now joined on the Voices for Victory podcast by Jennifer Halsey. Jennifer, thanks so much for taking a few minutes to chat with us today.
Thanks for having me, Mick. I'm excited to be here.
So we're going to dive in and talk a lot about the BRCA or BRCA gene today, the ramifications of testing positive for that, sort of what that all means. But to start us off, I think it makes sense to start by going back to really where the cancer journey for you and your family began, which is with your mom, who was diagnosed back in 2006. What do you remember about sort of when she first realized something might be wrong and then when she was diagnosed?
Yeah, so my mom was diagnosed with ovarian cancer and they didn't catch it until stage 3C, which is not uncommon, unfortunately, for ovarian cancer because it has very few symptoms that people recognize. So she actually didn't have any symptoms. She was going to her regular gynecological appointments every year. And during her normal pelvic exam, she had some pain. And so her gynecologist decided to do an ultrasound. And at that point, they saw some tumors that were very visible, large tumors. So they put her through for, you know, a CAT scan and a PET scan and all kinds of other testing. And it ended up that she had a 4-inch tumor and an 8-inch tumor with no symptoms.
Wow.
So, yeah. So that's, you know, one of the scariest parts of ovarian cancer is that it is very silent. And at that point, no one was really testing broadly for the BRCA mutation or other genetic hereditary cancer mutations. So we didn't really know much about the genetic predisposition of ovarian cancer.
So what was, when, you know, when they found the tumors there, what was kind of the plan of attack? Was there, was, did they think the diagnosis had some potential for a positive outcome? What was sort of, after they found these, kind of where was the mindset of the doctors?
Yeah. So she was treated at the Cleveland Clinic. I'm originally from Erie, Pennsylvania, which is where my parents lived. My dad still lives. So they went about an hour and a half to Cleveland for her treatment. And the doctor said that with this type of ovarian cancer, they can treat it with chemo and it tends to retreat a bit, but then it also tends to come back very often. And so the prognosis was sort of mixed in that way. They felt like they could beat it back at first, but then they weren't very confident that it wouldn't come back later, which is exactly what happened. So she had a total of 72 different chemo treatments at the Cleveland Clinic. And then she lost her battle with the ovarian cancer in 2011 after it metastasized to her bones, which was a really painful way to sort of have that that ending.
Yeah, that's, of course, the a tough ending there. And I wonder, you know, there's so many negatives that come from having to watch your mom go through all of that. And I wonder if there's any positives you remember from that time, whether it was a conversation you had with your mom or a funny quip she had in a tough time, something that you remember kind of brightly and fondly about what was obviously a very tough time for you and your family.
Yeah. I mean, she always said it is what it is. And she was very accepting of every step along her journey. She just faced it head on. She didn't take a lot of time to sort of, you know, traumatize it or feel upset about it or feel sorry for herself. She was just extremely future focused. And, you know, until the very end, she really did not even acknowledge that this could result in her death. I mean, it was like not something we even talked about. And in some ways that made it a little harder because we never had those conversations of where, you know, you feel like when people are at the end of their cancer journey, they can at least talk with their families and say, okay, now after I'm gone, you know, these are my wishes for you or whatever. But my mom was really staunch in her brave face. And she was not going to acknowledge that this could kill her even up to the end. And so I'll always remember that because she had hope the entire time and because she was so focused on what came next and tackling the next hurdle.
And that's such a mom thing, right? Like everything's gonna be fine. Don't worry about me. You know, like I just think that attitude is just kind of exemplifies what a mom is all about. So, you know, you deal with this, you know, your mom passing away and then, a few years down the road, your aunt, your mom's sister was also diagnosed with I believe it was also ovarian cancer. You know, that's obviously difficult to go through as well. Your aunt gets sick and passes away. But was that the sort of point where you're like, hey, this might be something genetic in our family that we need to take a look at?
Definitely. I mean, you know, I was always concerned from the beginning that maybe this would happen to me too, just, you know, being her daughter. But then when my aunt, whom I was really close to, was diagnosed, she was at stage 4 when she was diagnosed. She ended up being hospitalized for complications with COPD, so not even related. And they found a lot of fluid in her abdomen. So upon, you know, doing some more further testing for that, they found stage 4 ovarian cancer. And it was at that moment that I think, you know, we all knew that this had to have some kind of genetic component. Because as you guys probably know, the general population has like a 2% chance of getting ovarian cancer if you're a female. And, you know, for two out of three sisters to have it seemed to us to be definitely one of the hereditary cancer factors. So
that, you know, that seed is sort of planted in your mind, you know, when your aunt passes away. You know, you and your husband are lucky enough to have two great kids. I'll say, I hear that one is a Mason. I also have a Mason. So shout out to the other Mason parents out there. Yeah. So you guys have a couple of kids, and then, was that the point when you have two kids and you say, okay, it's time to maybe get this test and see, now that genetic testing has improved to the point where it is, let's see kind of what we can find out. Kind of walk me through the process of how you made that decision.
Yeah. So, I mean, we have two little boys, a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and they're wild, which is part of why we just looked at that and went, oh my goodness, we could not handle a third. So it was kind of clear to us that we had completed our family. And at that point, I always knew that I would go forward with the genetic testing. I just didn't want to do it until I was ready to actually act on the results. So, for example, I didn't want to do the genetic testing and then be making decisions about marriage and children with that in my head. I didn't want that to be sort of like a rush on me to, you know, get married or have children. I felt like I would make mistakes if I sort of had that ticking time bomb hanging over me if I was positive. And as it turns out, of course, I was positive. And it was much, I think, better for me to know that at a time when I was ready to sort of immediately act on it, so that it didn't just stick in the back of my mind and sort of, you know, overshadow every experience of my life from here on out.
So once you get the positive tests, kind of talk us through what the next steps are that you're, I think, still currently going through right now. Kind of what was you know, step one, and then on down the line of the plan.
Yeah, so I went to my OBGYN and had the genetic testing done. It was a very simple blood test. I received the results at the end of March of 2020, so just a few months ago, really. And I was BRCA1 positive, and my particular variant of the mutation gives me an 89% chance of getting breast cancer and a 64% chance of getting ovarian cancer. So again, to put that in perspective, you know, the general female population has, I think it's like an 11% chance of breast cancer, and mine was 89%, and then less than 2% chance of ovarian cancer, and mine was 64%. So seeing all of that was a really difficult, you know, step for me. And I think for a lot of BRCA positive or gene mutation positive people, it's really tough because most of us have also been mourning our family members who've been lost to cancer. So, you know, most people who get tested for these gene mutations, they get tested because they have that family history, and that family history comes along with so much grief. And so it's almost like an emotional process just to get yourself to go and have the test and look at the results and, like, you know, face that. So once I got those results, I had my first mammogram. It happened to be on my 40th birthday. So happy birthday to me. And it was very quick. I mean, even despite COVID and all of the things that that brings and the challenges that that has brought, I found that the doctors that I have been working with are very responsive because of this gene mutation and because of its aggressive nature. So they really moved things quickly for me and made sure I got the screenings that I could get right away. And then within probably the first 4 to 6 weeks of knowing my results, I had a genetic counselor appointment with the genetics team at Duke. I met with breast surgeons and reconstructive surgeons and gynecological oncologists to discuss all my options and what monitoring would look like and what surgical intervention would look like.
So, yeah. And you mentioned, you know, I think it's a great point that maybe people don't think about as much, but anyone who's going down this path is usually going down it because they've had these, you know, negative outcomes for family members. So I wonder, as you're going through it, you know, we talk a little bit about the physical toll that you've gone through, which I'm sure is a lot too, but the emotional toll of it, is it tough to, you know, kind of every conversation you have or meeting with a doctor or a test you take, I'm assuming has to bring up thoughts of your mom and your aunt who have, you know, had gone through this and maybe didn't have the testing available or the options to do what you're doing now. Does that, you know, does that make it tough emotionally for you every time you're going through something with this?
Absolutely. And it's kind of it's a mixed bag, right? Because I feel in many ways very blessed to know this.
Sure. Yeah.
And because I know that, you know, if my mom had known, she would have not hesitated for a second to get those surgeries and to get everything, to do everything she possibly could have to extend her time. And so in some ways I'm overflowing with gratefulness that I know this information, but it's also difficult because you're sitting in the same chair that, you know, philosophically that you know that your mother was in, and she heard very different news, and it's just very scary, you know, and you feel a bit of survivor guilt too, because of all of the people out there who find out, you know, about their hereditary situation because they have a cancer diagnosis. And so I'm lucky to not have a cancer diagnosis at this point. And, you know, you feel almost a bit guilty about that, but yet also very blessed. So it's definitely an emotionally complex situation.
And so now take us through kind of where you are physically with the process right now. How are things going? Where do you kind of stand with everything that's going on right now?
Yeah. So luckily, you know, I've had a lot of family support. You know, my immediate and extended family almost immediately rallied around this idea of doing these prophylactic surgeries. That was certainly my immediate response, was I want these ticking time bombs out. You know, I want to get the double mastectomy. I want to get the hysterectomy and oophorectomy. I want all of the parts that are so cancer prone to be out of my body ASAP. That's not, you know, necessarily the choice that everyone makes. And it's, you can have those options to monitor and continue to monitor. But, you know, my family and friends really did stand behind immediately my decisions, even though I think at first it might seem extreme. It's like, okay, you got this genetic test and now you're just going to go in, you're going to have these major surgeries and you're going to, you know, remove all these body parts. And isn't that sort of reactive? And maybe you should just monitor for a little bit. But, you know, I think we're in a time now where people know more and more about this. You know, maybe it's the Angelina Jolie factor. I don't know, but it seems like people are more familiar with these tests and are understanding the outcomes a bit more. And, you know, looking at these numbers, I think it's very obvious to me, at least, that it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And monitoring would only buy you a little bit of time. And when do you stop monitoring? You know, when you have cancer, or do you stop monitoring when you're, you know, physically ready for surgery? That might be the case for some people, but thankfully, I was in a position where, you know, I was ready to just move forward. I have a job that, you know, I've been at for 15 years and I was able to take the time off. I know that's a consideration for some folks about, you know, the cost of your co-pays and all of that kind of stuff and your time out of work and your recovery can be very difficult depending on the types of surgeries you choose and the reconstructive efforts. So what I chose to do is have a double mastectomy and a deep flap reconstruction first. And when a patient like me chooses to do a double mastectomy, you can choose a couple of options for your reconstruction. First of all, you can go flat. So you can remove the breasts and not replace them. And I've seen women do that and be remarkably happy. And there's some really cool like tattoos and body art that people do when they stay flat. And it's really inspiring. But for me, it didn't feel like I could feel like myself. So I looked at reconstruction, and my two options were implants or using my own tissue. So I chose to see if I was a candidate for using my own tissue. It turns out I was. Thank you, having two kids and liking pizza. So I had the tissue to use, and I was like, okay, bonus, you know? So they cut my abdomen hip to hip, and took tissue from my abdomen to reconstruct breasts. And it's, of course, not breast tissue anymore. They removed all of that. It's abdomen tissue that's up in the breast area. It's a really complicated surgery. They don't do it everywhere. We're so fortunate in the Raleigh-Durham area to have Duke nearby, although there are several hospitals around the country that do this type of reconstruction, but it is microsurgery. So they essentially, it's like a tissue transplant. They essentially take the tissue and then they use the blood vessels within it and connect those blood vessels to the ones that are behind your heart or behind your rib cage and near your heart so that the tissue can get adequate blood flow. And the surgery itself, because of how complex it is, it takes like 10 to 12 hours of time on the table. So, you know, you have to be at least in decent condition to withstand, you know, being under anesthesia for that long. So not everyone is a candidate, but I was really fortunate to be able to do it. It's been a hard recovery, I'm not going to lie. They say that the recovery takes 8 to 12 weeks. It's taken every bit of that for me. And I had my surgery on July 15th, and I'm still kind of nursing some open wounds. And it's not a pretty process, you know. It can be almost barbaric. You know, wound care hasn't come as far as other areas of medicine, I feel like. You know, you're still just kind of like shoving stuff in holes and waiting for it to heal, which has been sort of, you know, upsetting. But I just keep telling myself that, you know, this is so much better. Any recovery effort is so much better than a cancer diagnosis. And, you know, God willing, I'm going to have my hysterectomy portion in November, and hopefully the pathology from that will come back clear. And I will get to sort of create a different ending to my life than my mom could or my aunt could or so many people who have to battle an active diagnosis.
Thank you so much for coming on and chatting with us. And of course, best of luck to you in your continued recovery. You mentioned you have another upcoming surgery, so we'll be thinking about you as you go through that. And we'll hope to come back and have you on again sometime later to tell us how everything is continuing to go for you.
I'd love to do that. Thanks a lot, Mick.
Thanks again to Carol Wagner and Jennifer Halsey for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation and maybe learned a few things too. If you haven't yet, please subscribe to the Voices for Victory podcast wherever you listen so you can know the second our new episodes are posted. And while you're at it, please, please leave us a 5-star review or a nice comment. It really helps. You can find out more about the V Foundation or make a donation by visiting v.org. And make sure to follow us on social media at the V Foundation. Once again, I'm your host, Mick McDonald, and I hope you'll join us next time on the Voices for Victory podcast.
To me, there are three things we all should do every day. We do this every day of our life. You're going to have, what a wonderful, number one is laugh. You should laugh every day. Number two is think. You should spend some time in thought. And number three is you should have your emotions moved to tears. Could be happiness or joy. But think about it. If you laugh, you think, and you cry, that's a full day. That's a heck of a day.